The Jericho Network on Westwood One. The following program is presented by the Jericho Network in association with Podcast One.
The world is a vampire.
Podcast One presents The Raven Effect with pro wrestling superstar Raven,
a cornucopia of stupidity masquerading as a podcast.
Critics have hailed it as everything from,
huh? Who's this Raven jerk?
And, if you want clever discourse, nonsensical banter, and incessant rambling, well, this is the show for you. Ladies, gentlemen, idiots, floozies, and reprobates, this is Raven.
Hello and welcome to the Raven Effect Podcast. First, let me introduce on the Wheel of Steel, on one turntable and no mic, my doggy Gabriel.
Wait, hold on. You haven't introduced me yet, but what? You changed it. It's one wheel, one microphone?
No, it's supposed to be two turntables and a mic or the wheels of steel. But my dog, Gabriel, he ate one of the wheels of steel and he decided to turn the microphone into a chew toy.
Oh, wow. Talk about burying the lead on that joke.
Eh, okay, what are you going to do?
Back to your blathering and my proper intro for me.
Don't forget. I got a good one for you. As for me, I'm your general with no mills, your Daffy Duck without a bill, a man who likes boats and moats and fire-breathing goats, and just the other day I played some bingo with a gringo who didn't speak my lingo, and then we went with Ringo, because he's a star, to a club so we could singo. Say, can you see? Well, Jose, can you see, or do you need a better seats with an unobstructed view? And speaking of obstructions, let me introduce my partner in crime, a man who loves the slime and the Dr. Funkenstein of white-collar crime, the rolling thunder of wonder and blunder, the Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer to my 1975's Fleetwood Mac album Rumors, the lewd, rude, and nude, fearful yet fearless, libation-drinking, ass-play-stinking, lover of low-rent, low-tech, low-cost strippers, hoes, and hookers, whether they're hot lookers, meth cookers, or indie show wannabe bookers. The devil may care, although the devil may not care, Duke of Dementia, the Baron of Brain Damage, the Wizard of Whoopee, Busby Berkeley!
That was excellent. That was the best one yet. That was great.
I think my throat hurts.
You think it does?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
You're going to consult someone? I got to, right off the bat, the Dr. Funkenstein of white-collar crime.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's good, because that guy's like raping everyone in that country club prison, right? Because he's got swagger.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
just in there. Yeah, yeah. I love it. I love it.
All sucking up to him at the white-collar crime prison.
Oh, for sure. He's the coolest guy there by like a million years.
Yeah, easily.
How you doing, my friend? How was your week?
I've got occipital neuralgia. It's an inflamed nerve in the neck. And it's really annoying. It gives you these migraines, and it's really aggravating. So I had to get a neural block today. I went to the doctors, and they stuck needles in my neck and shot in corticosteroids and stuff.
Is that from like landing on your neck and just like the rigors of the business?
Yes, I believe it has to be. I mean, what else would it be from? Just years of taking their toll.
Rubbernecking while driving?
What?
Rubbernecking while driving? Like,
I don't, you know, believe it or not, I don't rubberneck because I hate when other people rubberneck. So I make sure I look straight ahead and avoid looking at the accident so I can complain about everybody else. Let me say something about my neck. I learned this in Portland. I used to let people, you know, like drop kick me in the back of the head from behind when, in Memphis and Florida and in Portland, and the month I was Chippendale or whatever the hell I was called in Vancouver. So I remember, and then one time somebody drop kicked me in the back in Portland in the back of the head. And man, total whiplash. They totally stiffed me on it. And I was like, man, I can't gauge this from behind. I'm not taking anything to the back of the head no more, or even to the back. I mean, unless I can see it coming. And if you're waiting to get hit from behind, it's intrinsic that you don't see it coming for the surprise. But this is when I started to learn psychology, and I realized if I get hit from behind, it's exciting because the people can see the guy waiting, you know, so they know it's here it comes, and oh, Raven doesn't know it's coming, or Scotty the Body doesn't know it's coming. He's going to get it right in the back of the head. But if I wait a second or two, so now they see the guy standing behind me, they know he's ready to go, and I turn around and walk into it, now they get the added visual of my face going, ah!
Yeah. So it's like the difference between taking a pie in the face or the pie in the back of the head.
Exactly. And you would think that it's, you know, your first instinct as a wrestler is to take it from behind, so it's more by surprise. But it's still by surprise but in the front. And here's the thing. If you're waiting to get hit from something from behind, you either tense up and everybody can tell you're tense, or you don't tense up because you don't want it to look like it. And then you have no idea when it's coming and you're not tense and you get el kabonged.
Yeah, no, you're right, too, because what we want is to know that you feel like you got surprised.
Right. And you know, either way, it's counterintuitive to have the guy turn around, but it's actually even more beneficial because then you get to see his reaction.
Well, there was a lot of talk, and I think he stopped using the move, but Seth Rollins at WWE, he was doing this basically power bombing people into ring posts and outside walls.
That's not very nice.
No, I was going to say, these are friends of his probably.
Probably.
But you know, he had ended up injuring a couple people because, you know, they couldn't gauge the distance. Like, you know, because it wasn't just like to the mat where it just goes down. So they'd be thrown back and then instinctually would throw an arm back, or they would hit after they thought they'd hit. And it's kind of what you're talking about, which is you don't want to over brace yourself for it. Like, what was Perry's tech, the Eliminators?
Mm-hmm.
I always laughed when a guy overbraced himself for their finisher. Like, he literally cupped the back of his head and tucked his elbows and bent his knees to take that double kick. Because, like, I totally get why, but it was like, oh, that guy's too prepared. He could have jumped out of the way.
Right.
But, yeah.
And they were so smooth.
Right, like, you did all this work.
They were so smooth, it actually just puts you down gently on your back.
So it was more the fear of it happening that made guys do that. Yeah, that's interesting.
But mostly the only time guys really tense up is you have to if you're getting splashed off the top. Otherwise, because I was working Jimmy Superfly Snuka on the indie show, and he was so light. I mean, everything. Like, you know, wrestlers pride back in the day, they prided themselves on being light. Now everybody wants to work, you know, strong style, which is stupid because my mom could hit somebody for real. There's no skill. There's no art form in hitting a guy for real or hitting a guy hard. The art form is hitting the guy as soft as humanly possible, but making it look like you hit him, you know, balls out crazy. And, so I was working Snuka, and everything, you know, when he'd grab an arm, like a wrist, it was so light, you know, everything, every touch was so light, so that when it came time for him to splash me off the top, I didn't even bother tensing up like you normally do at the last second. And so he hit me. It was like, and first of all, watching it from laying on the ring is even more impressive than watching it from TV, because he jumps, he kind of turns in midair. And like Michael Jordan, he just hangs in the air. There's like a second or maybe a half a second, but it feels like 2 seconds when you're laying there, where he's just actually not going up and not going. Of course, he wouldn't be going up, but he's not going down. But where he's no longer going down or out, he's just stopped. And then he just drops like a ton of bricks out of the sky. And I was like, oh, I get it. And almost puked my lunch up.
Yeah, no, I can't even. How old was Snuka when you got to work with him?
Probably, I would say 20 years ago.
Maybe. Still an older guy.
But he was still, he still flew, though, like nobody's business. I mean, he still was Snuka. You know, he was still Snuka in every way, shape, and form. You know, even still jacked. You know, he hadn't reached old guy status yet. Like, he didn't look old yet. You know what I mean?
I got to tell you, one of my fondest memories when I was in WCW was we were at Nassau Coliseum and just watching Snuka and Gene Okerlund talking to like 21-year-old girls at the hotel bar. Like, it was just like so magical in so many ways. Just these two smooth, like it was both smooth and horrifying and everything you would want it to be.
I wish I would have been there. although I've seen Gene Okerlund's game many a time. He's a smooth rascal.
Oh, he is. And that voice, he's just an awesome guy, too. He's just the best.
You want to hear a funny thing, though? As fantastic as he is, even the greatest people screw up occasionally. And so me and Saturn were going out to do an interview, and we had just broken up as a team, and we had got back together. And so Saturn goes, Gene, he goes, I want you to say... he goes, I want you to say to me when the interview starts, hey, didn't you and Raven break up? And he's going to say, I didn't even know we were going out. Right? So me and Gene instead goes, yeah, Saturn. So it looks like you and Raven aren't a team together anymore. Or you guys are a team now, and you guys weren't a team, but now you're a team. And Saturn's like, wait, who said we were together?
So he's still trying to sit.
He threw it in to pop me.
Yeah, nothing funnier than watching a guy shovel buckets of water out of a sinking boat like that in a bit.
One of the best screw ups was I was coming out through the Saturday night. I guess it was on Nitro. No, they weren't on Nitro. The doors did open up with the clouds mm-hmm. of smoke coming out. The
smoke machine, just a fog machine.
It's actually. Dry ice or something.
Dry ice. Yeah.
So the dry ice, they turn the machine up way too much. That's what they make the smoke with. And so the smoke's billowing and I can't see a thing. And all of a sudden the doors open up and I go walking and I walked into one of the walls and it knocked me back a step. But luckily it was so smoky, nobody could tell.
Oh man. Some of my favorite memories are guys eating shit on entrances. I can remember. I think you were there. Were you there when Hoovy just literally tripped and rolled down the walkway for like,
no.
I mean, it was set. And, you know, he just jumped up so quickly. Thankfully, he was a baby face. So he just laughed and kind of had fun with it. But, oh, man, like nothing like seeing a guy come out and start to hit his series of signature entrance moves and then just take a tank or fall. It's the best.
Well, here's the thing, too, is if you're a heel, heels always, you know, because you're self-conscious, you immediately jump up and no-sell it. But there's why? If I was a whenever I screw up as a heel, I totally sell it like I screwed up because it gets you more heat, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's like that's the ego. Like that's like the person reacting embarrassed instead of the character taking advantage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And cause it's hard to remember that when it happens like accidentally, cause your first instinct is always cover up. You know, it's like that George Carlin bit about walking up the stairs and then you take that extra step that isn't there.
Yeah.
So you have to turn it into a dance. But going back to Portland, because that's where we left off, is a complete Portland screw up by me. I went to do a springboard clothesline on Rex King, and where you hook the ropes, you jump up, balance on the top rope, and then spring off. Except the ropes in Portland are plastic tubes around wire, so. I mean, they're fine for hitting ropes, but as far as doing a springboard, they rolled. So, and you never practiced anything because, you know, it's old school mentality. We don't, you know, back then nobody practiced moves, you know, you just did them. And so, so I said, I'm just going to try it. You know, I'll try it new on TV, on television. Cause, you know, why would I mess it up? I know I can do it because I know I could spring up to the top rope because the ropes aren't as high. WWE ropes, I couldn't spring to the top because those are super high. But NWA ropes, I could always spring to the top, even as unspringy as I am.
Yeah, you're not known as a springer.
Well, I'm no spring chicken, that's for sure. I'm a spring raven. So I went to spring up. I hit the rope. I landed on the top. I got up on the top rope, and it rolled, and it went, took a face plant, landed right at Rex's feet. But Rex had his back to me because I was hitting him from behind. So I had to reach out and grab his ankle with my hands and trip him. Oh, it was ridiculous.
You know, though, today, that sequence of moves, like if your big move was a springboard into a foot trip, that probably would get over huge.
The old springboard into a foot trip.
Hey, before, because I have a bunch of Rex King questions. I want to talk about him. But before we do, you know, I just thought it might be fun for like fans who haven't seen old Portland footage or anything like that to get more, because you talked about the venue and the bowling alley, but like just the sort of the in general, the who were the fans there? Like, what was that like? Like, what was Portland like in that regard?
Well, first of all, it was it held like 3,000 people when it was packed. And when it was packed, it was unbelievable. But it was always at least 1,000, 1,500 people there. So, and it was a two-camera shoot, but both cameras were located in the same place, and they were 3 feet from each other. But at least they had two cameras so they could cut from one to the other, even if it was basically the same shot. And Don Owens always wore his lime green leisure suit, and he would be in the corner introducing people. And the referee was Sandy Barr, who I used to say looked like Mo in the Three Stooges. So I was always going, just say Mo, directed at Sandy Barr, whose son was Art Barr, and his other sons, one was Jesse Barr, who was Jimmy Jack Funk, one was Art Barr, and the other one didn't wrestle. And he was a wrestler himself. He was known as Dandy Sandy Barr, which I have to see footage of that someday before I die, of him as a dandy. But
did he play a full dandy, like a foppish dandy?
I don't know. I guess so. But I mean, it's so not like knowing him, it's so not him. But, you know, who knows? People, when they let loose their personalities, you know, you never know what you get. But so the I think it was the first or second, maybe the third time Don Owens was introducing me. So he goes, in this corner, so-and-so, and then whatever. And then I come out and he goes, in this corner. Oh, no, I was out first. I'm sorry. Let me back that up. I was out first. And so I do my little dance. I come out with my valet. I dance in a ring, which you can see on Twitter. It's just it's ridiculous and preposterous. And frankly, well done, I must say. It was very well done. Very good dancing if you're epileptic. Now, I wasn't a bad dancer, but I wasn't a good dancer. And I came out to that song by Dino, That's the Way It Has to Be, because that's the way I like it. So it goes, that's the way it has to be, because that's the way I like it. So, yeah, I should have sung it. Yeah, that would have been real nice.
Oh, my God. If you wanted to get heat,
yeah,
you're just doing that. Just do that for like 20 minutes.
Yeah, who needs a band? Anyway, so I come down to the ring. I jump over the top rope to get into the ring. And my valet, I open the rope. She gets in. And Don Owens goes, in this corner. And then he realizes he doesn't have his sheet of paper and he hasn't memorized my name yet. So he calls over the referee. And this is all on TV. They never edited anything out because it was live to tape. So he makes a fingering motion. Come here. And the referee comes walking over. And they whisper. They have a little consultation. They whisper. Don whispers in Sandy's ear. And then Sandy walks down to me and whispers in my ear, he forgot where you're from. That's it. He forgot where you're. Or no, I don't know what he forgot, but he forgot your whatever. Tell him I'm Scotty the Body from such and such, and you know, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and 225 pounds or something. And then he walks back. I whisper in Sandy's ear this. Then Sandy walks back all the way along the ropes because I'm facing the hard camera. So we're in opposite. We're in the two corners. Don Owens is in one corner facing the hard camera, and I'm in the other corner. He walks from one end to the other. I whisper back in Sandy's ear. He walks back, and Don Owens goes, yeah, in this corner, like didn't even miss a beat. Like, how great is that? And then, like,
that's a good guy who's seen everything, though. That's right. Like, he's just seen it all.
Yeah.
Man.
I mean, he used to call me, like, when I first got there. Not that he didn't call 10 other people that before me, but he used the term the sensation of the nation. Isn't that great?
It's awesome.
It's so 1940s.
That's something Jericho would try to bring back now. Like, that's such a, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's so dated,
yeah,
and like vintage. And didn't you guys have like almost like a season ticket holder situation?
Yeah, yeah. Wait, I don't know if they had season tickets, which was a light or lifetime tickets, because if the front row, the hard camera, okay, there was the seats opposite the hard camera were well, people were well into their 70s and 80s that were sitting there. The only way you could get a front row seat, especially hard camera side, was if somebody died. Seriously.
The Supreme Court of wrestling, basically, was,
yes,
Portland.
You couldn't. No, there was no way to get one of those seats. You couldn't show up like after the, you know, be the first person to buy one, because I guess they had lifetime passes. But what made it even better was that there'd be old ladies in the front row knitting while the show was going on.
Come on.
I swear to God. Watched it. Watch. I have some footage of it. I have all, like, I saved all, like, you know, I recorded all the shows off of on a VCR, because that's what it was back then. And one of these days, I'm going to take all the tapes and I'm going to convert them and I'm going to do commentary over them. And so I'm going to commentate over my commentary and make basically make fun of myself.
But you're going to do like a director's commentary on your old tapes?
Like a Mystery Science Theater 3000. And so so they literally were knitting in the front row. There was like two or three knitters who always knitted in the front row of this. And they had to be 75, 80. So they'd been going since probably they were 20.
Oh, man. And were they like... beside the knitting, were they like vocal fans up front?
No, because they were too busy knitting.
Just straight knitting, like just getting stuff done.
Yeah, they were busy getting their stuff done. But it was such an institution that they just kept coming back, I guess. And I think they were kind of hot for their age.
Well, you know, having a hobby, that just keeps you young.
Keeps you young and virile.
And you said, speaking of, because you started, who was the commentator like when you were there?
Oh, Don Koss. Don Koss, and up until Piper got there, until Piper took over as the head booker from the Grappler, they never had smartened him up. Cause Don Owens was all kayfabe. Cause it was big time kayfabe in that town. I mean, in that territory, cause it was so small. So they didn't even smarten the commentator up. So he was out there, you know, like a chowder head trying to call stuff and having no idea, you know, assuming it's fake or it's a work, but having no definite answer and not knowing what the matches were. And luckily I didn't get there for that. But when Piper got there, he finally convinced Don Owens to smarten up, you know, to allow the commentator to come back before the show and get the show notes.
Well, you know, they didn't let us doing online stuff. They didn't smarten us up. We would just watch those shows, which also, I mean, obviously we called a bunch of those shows together. We didn't really call them anyway.
No.
But I got to tell you, there was a certain pleasure in not knowing what the show was going to be, like just kind of going out there and watching it and not. But at the same time, the few times we did try to call certain angles, sometimes if they were poorly executed, we came out with the totally wrong conclusion.
that's the best, like, because if you don't know what the storyline is, if the boys don't tell the proper story in the ring, you could come up with a completely different idea of what they were trying to do.
And Don Koss was kind of like, he was a catchphrase guy, right? Because he's from that old guard.
No, he wasn't a catchphrase guy, but he only had one thing that he would repeat. Like he didn't really have any catchphrases. Although he was kind of a straightforward kind of guy, really nice guy. And I gotta go back for half a second and say that not smartening up the commentator. This was when people, you know, nobody ever really believed that the outcome wasn't predetermined. I mean, for the most part, people always thought wrestling, you know, was a work, but. By the same token, this was still long ago enough. This is 28, 27 years ago. Yeah, 27 years ago when people still, you know, Vince hadn't given away, you know, hadn't told people that it was fake. Wrestlers all claimed it was real. So imagine trying to commentate and not being sure whether it is or it isn't. You know, I mean, it's and even if you're pretty sure it is, you don't want to cross over and step over the line. You know what I mean? It's got to be really hard to commentate. But he did develop one thing that every time there was a monkey flip, no matter if there was one monkey flip in a show or seven monkey flips in a show, he would go, "Monkey flip, there goes the monkey." Is that awesome?
That's like that today would pop me to like.
If- yes.
There goes the monkey.
The
I mean, technically, he's right.
Yeah.
He's right. I mean, if you're monkey. Well, see, here's the thing. I always thought.
You thought the guy doing the flip was the monkey?
I did. did you not think that?
I didn't think about it that much.
Like, yeah, for sure. Well, let's just take 1 second to unpack this. It makes way more sense that this is a way a monkey defends himself than it does to think that this is the only offensive strategy one can use against a monkey.
Wouldn't a monkey use jujitsu though instead of a monkey flip?
Why jujitsu?
Well, I don't know. I mean, jiu-jitsu's proven it because the monkeys are smaller, and it's for smaller people. They can use, you know.
I got you. I got confused. I was like, is there some relation between the development of jiu-jitsu and monkeys? Like, were the Gracies, like, trapped, like, in the woods, like that Gorillas in the Mist lady, and just that's how they learned? Did you BJJ?
The gorilla gave a BJ to the lady?
No, Gorillas in the Mist. Oh. You know what this is, right?
No, there was Stephen King's Mist didn't have any gorillas in it.
Oh, my God. Now, I can't even remember her name, and part of me doesn't care to remember it because you're just going to twist it. Diane Fossey. Diane Fossey. Remember Diane Fossey?
Was she related to Bob Fossey? Jazz hands.
Yeah, that's what I thought was going to happen. So, oh, that's so funny. There goes the monkey. I wish I knew that, I would have totally brought it back when I was announcing. I would have stolen that without any accreditation.
Oh, it's best. There's nothing better than not giving accreditation to somebody when they're a good friend of yours, or blatantly ripping off their material and then claiming it's yours. But then you'd have to have a car to make your escape.
For the monkey flip?
Well, if you had a car, you could just drive away. And if you had a car, but you didn't know where to get a deal, and you wanted to feel comfortable, well, in order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context. Information that empowers you to feel confident. With TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. From there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. And now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before going to a dealership so you can feel confident when you show up. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing so you can enjoy a quick, easy car buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP, and when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
It's the Raven Effect with Raven.
Hey guys, this is Chael Sonnen, and make sure you check out my podcast, You're Welcome. We talk about MMA, we talk about professional wrestling, politics, anything you need to know about today's top issues so that you can sound intelligent, and you get them all from me, your humble host, America's favorite gangster. Make sure you check me out, You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen, and new episodes every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, and of course, podcast1.com.
You are now experiencing the Raven Effect.
I know you did some really fun angles, and I want to talk about them. But also, we didn't talk about this last week, but you mentioned that you were on commentary when you got there. You were wrestling, but you had a segment too.
Yes. Yeah, so Piper liked my commentary, and he liked my wrestling. So he says, and Buddy Rose, who did the Rose Garden, which was like the interview segment. Like, didn't Jericho have one recently?
Jericho had the highlight reel. You right. Know, like, yeah.
Well, Buddy Rose had the Rose Garden, which was cool because in Portland, I think it's like the Rose State or something like that. And, the arena, the big arena is called the Rose Garden. So Buddy Rose had the Rose Garden was his segment. And, except he went back to the AWA, I think, cause they were still going. Him and Colonel De Beers, they went everywhere together. Oh, that was, they were such an entertaining pair.
What were they? They were a pair, like a tag team, right? They weren't
Well, no, I mean, in Portland, they were a tag team, but they weren't partners like in life. They were, you know, both of them were married. And I don't believe either was homosexual. So, although Buddy Rose did piss Andre the Giant off one time, and Andre shoved his thumb up Buddy's butt.
Is that true?
Yeah, Buddy told me.
Wait, so Was this during a match or was this just somewhere?
In the locker room, Buddy pissed him off. And so Andre grabbed him and shoved his thumb up Buddy's ass.
You realize, though, Andre's thumb is like a Coke Zero. Yeah, like I was trying to be classy. Yes, like I was saying a Coke Zero can.
I meant a rooster. I meant a rooster.
Oh, my God. I mean, I'm glad he could laugh about it because
he bragged about it. That's the best part. Buddy Rose, he was fat. He was about 5'10". No, he's about 6 foot, 270. And he was fat, but he still had big arms for some reason. But he also could outrun everybody in the 40.
Like at a sprint, he was that fast.
At a sprint. He beat everybody in the WWF locker room before.
Oh, wow.
As a shoot. Yeah, absolutely. He was an amazing athlete. If you ever want to watch a really talented worker, watch Buddy Rose. Oh, well, my God.
He was light.
Good.
I remember because he was actually a favorite of mine. And he was in that Adrian Adonis category of like he was like super light on his feet. Like he would bump. Yeah. Like he would just like float. It was crazy for his size.
He's one of the I still think the lightest person on their feet I've ever seen is Barry Windham in his prime. But Buddy was definitely in the top 10 that I've seen.
And back then, like, I'm always curious about this because, like, now you're coming in. You definitely have more of a mind of, like, you know, the guys who weren't body guys, did they do anything? Like, did they exercise at all? Was there a separation between body guys and guys who, like, looked more like the old school guys?
Back then, I don't think everybody worked out back then. Or if they did the old school workout. You know, they bench press, you know, 10 sets and, you know, maybe a couple other things. And then they'd go home, you know. I trained so hard. Like, I can't believe how hard I trained and how little gains I got. I have the most the most genetically non-growing body. I mean, I get gassed up on steroids and I still wouldn't grow worth a crap. I mean, the amount of steroids I took, I should have looked like Lex Luger. I mean, seriously. Well, I mean, you can't just take steroids and grow, but you have to train. But I trained that hard too from the time I was 16. You know, I mean, I just when I started lifting, I had 11-inch arms. Think about that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and 17-inch thighs.
And a face full of sand, if the ads are correct.
Yes, a face full of sand. Yeah, some rube man kicked sand in my face. How dare he?
And there was some other guy drawing it from a distance. What was he up to?
Yeah, what was that all about, creep?
but back to Buddy. So he left and he had the segment. It opened up a segment possibility.
Right. Open up a segment and, make sure we get back to Colonel De Beers sometimes, who was an amazing worker and, an amazing character. Just a great guy. Actually, let me just tell a quick Colonel De Beers thing here.
Go.
So Colonel and Buddy always rode together. They were best friends. And Colonel De Beers, his wife owned a Portland dog track. So they had money, right? Or her family did. But Colonel was a bit thrifty himself. And he'll tell you that he was a bit thrifty, a bit cheap. And whenever we would go on a trip, whether the trip was 40 miles or 250 miles, he would buy 3 40-ouncers on the ride home of the cheapest beer you could find.
Three.
He always drank 3 40-ouncers. That was the exact perfect amount of beer for him, and he would drink it in a 40-mile trip, or he'd drink it in a 200-mile trip. And he would splurge, though. Like, sometimes he would buy hams, 40-ouncers. Sometimes he would buy no-name 40-ounce beer.
Oh. Like,
yeah, but he was the best. Like, they did this storyline called The Breakfast Club, The Grappler and Nord, where they beat up Bryan Adams and poured milk and cereal on him. And and they called themselves The Breakfast Club. And so so the security knows to bring anything that happens in the ring, bring it back to the locker room. So they brought back the half-empty boxes of cereal that were half-ripped open. And Colonel goes, excuse me, because he talked like that in real life, too. He goes, excuse me, Grappler. He goes, is anybody going to be taking those boxes of cereal with them? And the Grappler's like, no. He goes, good. The kids will be eating Cheerios tomorrow.
What a character.
Oh, he was the best. And his gimmick, oh, man, it was so racist. Oh, my God.
Oh, that's the thing I remember. I mean, he got some volcanic heat. Like, it was straight up, like, antebellum South racism going on in his
gimmick. He missed the boat by 10 years, basically by 10 years. Because if he was one of those guys who was always recognized by the boys, he was a worker, a worker's worker. The boys always marked out for him. And if he would have been 10 years later, he would have caught the changing zeitgeist where he could have done it on a national, you know, there's no way Vince was going to bring in a racist, you know, Colonel De Beers, his family owned the diamond mines in South Africa. That's where he got it, De Beers diamonds. And he always said, he goes, I refuse to wrestle unless the man is a Caucasian.
God. Holy mech.
Yeah, and Vern let him do it on the AWA, but it wasn't Vern's show was going downhill at that point. But but Vince wouldn't do it because Vince was still into the kids market then. But if he would have been 10 years later, oh my God, he would have made so much money because he was like 6'3", 260 off the gas. I mean,
yeah, just natural.
Just natural and entertaining. The boys loved him. An amazing worker. He just never had found the right shtick before. But this is how good a worker he was. He was supposed to wrestle Brian Adams. We're in an armory one night. And so we're in the heels and baby faces are separated, separate locker rooms. So we're in the heel locker room and the colonel is going, man, I got to work with Brian Adams. And Brian Adams never became a great worker. He's always been one of the funniest, nicest guys in the business. Absolutely one of the best. Loved and adored by everyone, but never one of the great workers. Never going to be considered a great worker. Now imagine 20 or 30 years ago, or 28 years ago when he just learned how to work and he learned how to work in Japan.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. El Cemento. So there's nothing worse than having to work a guy that size, you know, 280, you know, who's just a monster, just, you know, maybe 300 pounds, you know, for 15 minutes on a spot show, you know, in an armory in front of 100 people and get clobbered to death, you know. And Brian had no psychology back then. You know, he was just learning. And I used to get stuck with, the worst part was the grappler. After I learned how to really work, the grappler stuck me with everybody. Like, they brought in Scott Norton. It was his first territory other than Japan. I had to work with Scott Norton. Oh my God, what a wrecking machine he was. The big juicer they put me with, and just all these guys. It was half a rib and half because I could carry them. But it sucked because I'd get stuck doing 15 minutes with these guys and getting my brains beat in. You know, not intentionally, you know, they just, you know, they were learning, you know, everybody he has was. To learn.
You ever heard this real quick Scott Norton story? I don't know if you ever heard this before, but you know how in the NWO days, guys would have to, especially the guys who were like on the fringe, would have to stay under the ring the whole Nitro so they could do that big show ending like pop where they would sneak out. Attack.
Yeah.
Well, Kurt Hennig, you know, he was friends with a lot of those guys because they were all from that Minneapolis area. And one time before a Nitro, Kurt took a shit in a bucket.
Well, he had it. I've heard this, but remember now, you're under the ring there for 3-4 hours. So you have to go to the bathroom, you know?
Yeah. So, but again, he.
But not shit. You could take a piss in a bucket, but not shit in one.
I was told that he did this before the show started.
Oh, and just really?
Oh yeah, this is, and I mean, I was told the story the day or two after that Kurt shit in the bucket that was under there for them, put it back, and so when these guys, when the lights went out at the beginning of Nitro,
oh, I thought he was under there with them.
No.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, it's so great. And so these guys, they rush in the darkness, go under the ring, and there's already a bucket with a big shit in it, and they have to sit. And that, by the legend goes, that these guys. All like vomiting, like,
yeah,
they were just like,
smell was so
and
good.
If you watched,
oh
yeah, cloying and thick. And I do remember, I mean, I don't know where the footage is now, but I do remember someone showing me footage when these guys came out. They all looked like they'd had the flu for a month, like they just, but yeah, you know, Scott Norton's, especially even as a guy backstage around monsters, like that guy was just like a huge boulder, like just big and thick and. Like,
yeah.
No give. I can't even imagine working with him early on, much less when he had learned a little bit, you know?
And he always would stick his tongue out when he was hitting you. And I kept telling him, don't stick your tongue out. He never did, but I was afraid he was going to bite his tongue off, like, you know, by accident. Like, it's just a weird habit he had, but he eventually got rid of it. So Colonel DePierce is working Brian Adams. And, oh, and don't let me forget to tell you, make a note, we'll get to this, probably not today, but my Scott Norton and the cat stories. The cats.
Gotcha.
Okay, so there's a little cliffhanger for you folks. So Colonel DePierce goes, oh, what am I going to do with Brian Adams? So then he he's wandering around looking for props or something. And you know, nobody really used props back then like they do now. So, but he was looking for something that he could just, that would give him a thought. And he saw this book and it said job book on it, like some little notepad. And I guess it was like jobs, army jobs that you had to do or something, but job book. It gave him an idea. He's like, all right, I got it. So he walks out to the ring, gets in the ring. The bell rings because you had to get your time in after the bell rang. So you made sure the bell, you know, matches like that. If you're going to do any gaga, you made sure the bell rang as soon as possible so that the gaga would be counted as your time. So Colonel DePierce, look, so he's about to lock up. And just as he's about to, he stops and backs up and thinks and has a think. Grabs his chin like he's thinking, like a little chin wag. He's just amazing. The little quirks and things he did were so amazing. And he goes back, pulls a book out of his pocket, the job book. Just as ironic that it said job book on it because he was doing the job. Anyway, so he pulls the job book out and flips it, starts flipping through the pages. Now, nobody else knows what it is. And then he starts making motions like a full Nelson, like how to apply it. Like he's teaching himself how to do a full Nelson out of the book. He folds the book back up and it's like a notepad, like a flip notepad, like a cop would have. So it's a very small book and he sticks it back in his pocket and he locks up with Brian Adams and he snaps on the full Nelson. And then he tells Brian to hit it, you know, to pull his belly forward and shove his ass back into his balls and knock him backwards and to release the hold. So Brian does that. He goes staggering back, stops, waits, goes back to his corner, pulls the book out again. Riffles through the pages till he finds the right page and starts pantomiming the full Nelson again. Closes the book up, puts it back in his pocket. So now 3-4 minutes are already gone, right?
Right.
So he locks back up, puts the full Nelson on. Brian escapes again. The colonel is frustrated. Now, that's one thing heels never do is they never show frustration. It's just, it makes no sense because that's why heels cheat, because they show frustration because they get right. frustrated by the babyface. Otherwise, there's no reason to cheat. But nobody ever does it. So anyway, so he gets frustrated. He kicks the bottom rope, old school style, you know, and he's about to lock up and he's like, wait a minute. Now he goes back to the book, riffles through it, and he finds it. Now he starts doing a different motion, goes to lock up with Brian Adams, spins, does a duck under, go behind, and a full waist lock cinch. So he's got to run the thing. And then finally, Brian busts out of that, and the colonel goes back to the corner. And now like 7-8 minutes are gone, and they only had to go like 10. So now the colonel went out there, just let Brian punch him a couple times and hit him with his finish.
You know, what I love most about that story is it shows how even like a little flip book like that, like even something small like that, is still a pain to carry around with you. You know what I mean? What if that match happened yesterday and instead of having to carry around that job book, he could have simply had a Bluetooth in his ear and listened to that same instruction on audible.com.
Wow. Amazing segue. You totally had me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. I'm just showing how it's done.
Yes, you are. And so listen here. This is the best thing about audible.com. For you, the listeners of The Raven Effect, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, they have books like, where were you? You were talking about Charlemagne the God.
Yeah, he's got a new release coming out. I believe it's the book that it's his best-selling book, but he reads it. It's great.
Oh, Black Privilege.
Yeah, he kills it. Oh, and Ricky Gervais, he's got a bunch of stuff on there, like just from his variety series, he just kills it.
And him, you got to hear his own voice. Yeah. Nobody else can do his voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? If you're just a fan of like jokes, like they've just got all these joke collections, and like there's just so much stuff, you get lost in it.
Like I Can't Make This Up, Life Lessons by Kevin Hart. I mean, Amy Schumer's new book. I mean, there's so much to get. I mean, they have so many gazillions of books. It's mind-boggling. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/Raven. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Raven for your free audiobook.
Hey, kids! Do you love the intense but focused and emotional work of renowned character actor Paul Giamatti?
Yeah! Yeah!
Well, now you can take him anywhere with new Giamatti trading cards from Upper Deck. It's a slew of Giamattis in all of your favorite roles.
I got Tom Duffy from Ides of March.
I got Freeman from 12 Years a Slave. In your face!
All your favorite Giamatti characters are here. Shorty, Mr. X, Cleveland Heap,
yeah!
Even Ben Bernanke.
I got Man in Sleeping Bag from NYPD Blue.
But it's not just his role. These cards also feature Giamatti as you've never seen him. Oops, I've spilled something.
Nice!
Man about town. You call this an antique?
Whoa!
These eggs aren't over easy.
I got taking a steam bath?
With 180 cards to collect, you'll have to trade with your friends. One lucky collector will get a gold hologram card of Mr. Giamatti as Chuck Rhodes from the show Billions.
Nice!
Get your free pack today by downloading and listening to the Team Tiger Awesome Show every Sunday, right here on the Jericho Network and Podcast One.
You're listening to The Raven Effect.
Back to the podcast now.
Now we're going to talk segment. So we had some fun, but we're going to go back. So let's talk about the segment that you had in Portland.
Oh, yes, the segment I had in Portland. I thought you were talking about segments on the show. That's why we really need to have a production meeting.
You know, but what if we lose this easy error of conversation?
Error.
I'm not going to clarify. I think we both know what I meant.
So anyway, so they had me because I was the pretty boy, good looking heel, the snotty to the body. They had me feud with Steve Dahl, one half of the Southern Rockers, who were the hot baby face tag team. And Steve Dahl was like this really, really good looking guy. So we had our little feud, and then so Piper gave me a segment, and I called it the Hamper.
The Hamper. What yes. Do you mean? Like
so,
a clothing?
Because I was going to air dirty laundry.
Oh boy, man, this is a magical time for wrestling. What you're describing.
It was magical. It was magical for me too, because I was learning everything. I was learning how to work. I was on the road every night with a secure job, making money. I mean, it was magical. The way you mean it, like ironically, but it was magical for real for me. I mean, it was like it was heaven. I couldn't believe I was doing this and getting paid for it.
And what, just to say, like, so the, it's just your segment, like, walk us through. Is it just you're on a stick? Like, what is the hamper? Is there a hamper set?
There was no hamper per se. What I had made was a big sign that said Scotty the Body. I paid for him to make, and there was no budget. So I paid for him and had a sign maker make a big, you know, one of those signs that said Scotty the Body on it, which I think I might, no, I don't think I have it anymore. Maybe I do. Anyway, yeah, but it wasn't like now where you can get it and you can unroll it. It was back then. It was, you know, on a piece of foam, hard foam or something.
Oh, yeah. So super hard to carry around.
Yeah, yeah. But so what my plan was, you know, my wrestling character's plan, the psychology was I was going to try and set up some heat between Steve Dahl and his partner, Scott Peterson. I was going to air their dirty laundry and try and cause a divisive wedge in between the two. But it was foiled by them because they were good looking young rah-rah baby faces. And I got El Kabonged for it. El Kabong! And don't you forget it, the Baba Louie.
Oh, man. And was this how this is how you start feuding with these guys, was essentially you deciding to air their dirty laundry, which is so, I can't stop laughing.
More or less.
But at this point, just to be clear, you were commentating?
Yeah, it's an hour and a half show from 11 to 12:30 on Saturday night. And it outdid Saturday Night Live in the ratings.
And you're on it like up sometimes upwards of, sometimes you're commentating the whole show.
Always commentated the whole show.
And wrestling, and then doing a segment too?
Yeah, way too much.
That's a lot. Yeah, no, that's great though, right? You must have been so excited to get that much
jazzed.
Time.
I was so bummed out when they took away my hamper segment. but I knew Piper was right. Piper's like, look, you're all over the TV. You're way too much on the TV show. You're just going to you're going to have the exact opposite effect. Instead of heat, it's just going to be annoyance. It's going to be the wrong kind of heat. So they took my segment from me, and so it only lasted like 3 weeks, 2 weeks. And they gave it to Al Madrill. And since Buddy had the Rose Garden, Al made it, because Al's Mexican, he had the Fiesta Garden.
That doesn't make any sense.
What do you mean it doesn't? Fiesta.
There's no such thing. There's no such thing as a party garden. A Rose Garden is an actual thing.
Yeah, but now he's playing off of Rose Garden to Fiesta Garden.
Oh, my God. That's so amazing. I love it.
Yeah. And Al Madrill's big thing was he hated the kids.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, so he was always feuding with Beetlejuice, which was a Piper-created character.
Hold on. I think Beetlejuice might not have been created by Piper exclusively.
Well, it might have been a movie first, or a Howard Stern or a Howard Stern Whack Pack character.
I love that this original idea that happens to have the name of like a multi-million dollar movie success.
Wait, it was an original idea based on the movie. Basically, Art Barr wasn't getting over as Art Barr, but he was a hell of a talent. But he was one of the guys Piper took under his wing. So before I had gotten there, they did a thing where Piper transformed him. So they grabbed like a big blanket, I think, and they held it around him, and Piper made him strip off all his clothes. And then he put on some Zubaz-looking things and some sneakers, I guess. And then he put on a tank top with a jean jacket over it. And then he put black smeary makeup on his face and white powder on. And then Piper poured a ton of baby powder into his hair, so his hair had a white, but it also came flying out of his hair as he ran. And he became the Beetlejuicer.
Oh, my God.
And he rode to children everywhere.
So, wait, children liked him or were terrified by him?
They loved him. And so when Beetlejuice would come to the ring, he would start dancing, you know, not really dancing, but just like, you know, hey, wee, yay, and his arms up and down. And the kids would come out, and he would motion for the kids to come join him. So all the kids in the building would get behind him. And sometimes the line of kids behind them would be like, you know, think about between the guardrail and the ring. You could fit about 5-6 kids there, right?
Yeah.
And 4 or 5 kids across. The guardrail was a lot closer there. So maybe 4 kids across, 5 kids across. And then they had a line of them, but they're all schmozzed up together, you know. And sometimes a line would circle all the way around back to in front of them.
So that many kids? So it was like a sea of children.
A sea of children.
Oh, man. So that was – you know what's so funny? When you were describing – how this transformation and the powder and the dancing, I was like, that also could be the character in a movie of someone who murders children.
Absolutely.
It's so great. Oh, man, I love this gimmick.
So he always brought the kids. And then Don Owens, like every couple of months, Don Owens would have kids free. And Al Madrill would go crazy, go, no kids free.
And then, it's basically, he would just constantly. And did he get over as a heel? Just
oh my
hating
god,
children.
People hated him because he hated the kids. That's what he would always
say. Good.
I hate the kids.
I miss this. Oh, that's so great.
Oh, wait till you see some of the storylines we did. Like when I went, I came up with this idea for a storyline. Okay, so remember the crack whore that I met. And I had her be my valet, and as the show started,
crack lady.
I'm sorry,
crack lady.
And as she wasn't a whore, she really wasn't. She just had a crack problem. Well, it wasn't even a crack problem. She really just had she didn't have a problem with it. She did it, and she didn't do it.
Appreciation, if anything.
She wasn't addicted. Put it that way. So anyway, so as I said last week, the first time I brought her, she was busy stuffing her boob back into her top. And I decided to make her my permanent valet because she was fun to sleep with. And she was there on time. She didn't, you know, bug me or aggravate me. And it was really getting tiresome bringing a different chick every week because it was every week we did TV. And so she became a regular, and then she became my valet, and she would come to the ring with me. And then eventually I treated her so poorly, she left me for Steve Dahl.
And this is Ginger.
Yeah, Ginger. So she leaves me. Yeah. She leaves me and joins up with Steve Dahl, my arch nemesis. And then about, I don't know how long, a few weeks play by, go by, and I keep, I don't care. And then I decide I want a winner back. And the week I decide I want a winner back, we bring in a new girl, Veronica, who I named her Veronica because I thought of like the Veronica from the Archie comics, kind of snooty and, you know, stuck up. So we brought her in. She was a mistress of one of the promoters in the Northeast, whose name I will not mention because I like the guy and I would not want him to get in trouble. But he was definitely. I think she was also had slept with somebody else in the business. One person whose name I don't think I should mention either. Although I probably could, but why bother? But anyway, so it wasn't like she was a rat. My point is she wasn't a rat. She was, she went with one guy and then finished up with him and then went with the promoter. And then, so he ended up, and she wanted to get, be a valet. So he booked her into Portland. You know, he called Don Owens up and asked for a favor, and we needed another girl anyway. So she comes in and so her first episode, she comes out and she says, she's like, I'm out there with her. And she's like, oh, it's so great to be with you. I go, you can be my valet, but I'm trying to win back Ginger. So there's no hanky panky.
Like that actual phrase?
That actual phrase I used. Because it just seemed to fit the climate.
Oh my God, these angles are so good.
Yeah, so this is also how I learned how to book too, because the grappler made me think about different stuff. Okay, what are you going to do next week? So now we go for a couple of weeks where I'm trying to, talk to Ginger, but Steve Dahl, every time I come out to ringside to talk to her, Steve Dahl chases me off. Cause she was valeting, the Southern Rockers. And in the meantime, while I was doing that, Veronica would go into the crow's nest and start crying. Why doesn't he love me? Why doesn't Scotty love me? And she was so perfect to be the character. Cause she really had a bit of a snootiness to her. But she's a really great chick. She ended up marrying Rex King for real, who became the other Southern Rocker with Steve Dahl after Scott Peterson, quit. Because his wife and him were having problems, and he'd rather say, well, I really respect this. He wanted to save his marriage over. Marriage was more important than the business. So he quit the business to make sure his marriage worked out, and they moved away. And Rex King finally now was in a spot where he could be a hot young baby face, that he wanted to be. This is the character he wanted to play. So it was really cool.
Well, you know what? I'm actually going to put a pin because we're at about an hour, and this is like, I know this angle, and it's an epic angle.
Yeah, but let me just say one thing, though. This isn't about the angle. But so what was great was during the matches, I would grab – like whenever I was in a tag match against the Southern Rockers, I would grab Rex after – and they got married like within a week, literally within like a week. And I'd grab Rex from behind, and I'd bring him over to his wife, his real-life wife, but my valet, and I'd make her slap him. What a heel.
That's so good. It's so good.
Okay, I gotta ask you something now. How do you feel now about Ryan Seacrest being with Kathy Lee? Because you used to be his head writer, right?
Yeah, my
Kathy Lee
Kelly.
Kelly
Ripa.
Yeah, Kelly.
Kelly Ripa, who's from my hometown, by the way, and also grew up not too far from you because you were born in Jersey, right?
I was born in Philly.
Oh, okay. Well, not too far. She's a Kelly Ripa's from South Jersey.
So is Kellyanne Conway, that really annoying Trump spokeswoman. Ugh, hate her.
So kind of my story with Ryan was when I was like a struggling kind of screenwriter out here, I was at we shared the same agency, and they got my writing partner and I jobs writing for his morning radio show out here for three years. It was actually a life-changing job for me because
I know
it was the first steady check. And also it was like kind of a return to like this entertainment stuff. I met Hulk Hogan a bunch of times on this job.
Really?
Because he was coming in with Eric all the time pitching. Like they would come in and promoting different shows.
And Scott Baio?
I wish that monster. Hulk, remember Hulk was doing all that reality stuff back then.
Sure. He's always doing some kind of reality something.
Let me tell you too, and this is the thing about him that's so amazing, and it's you. It's one of those things that, like, I think even you, like, who had a great career, when you look at a guy like on the Mount Rushmore, that level of a career like that he had.
Yeah.
I was a nobody. I was a guy who was like a fifth string announcer who met him a couple times. I walked up to him in the green room politely just to say, hey, you know, we used to work together. And he worked me for like an hour. Like he sat like, who am I? Like just about the business and what he wanted to do and how he's thinking of coming back. Like just like he was on a soapbox running for office. And I'm like, this guy does this all day.
So charismatic.
Oh my God. Well, the first time I met Hulk, I was at the toy fair in New York, and I barely even had a job at WCW then. And we were all rushing out of the toy fair, and the NWO was the big toy that was being brought out at the toy fair. And we were being treated like stars. And I accidentally got into his limo because there was five.
Did you have one? Did you have one, the kilt you stole from Piper?
I know. Like what? I feel like I probably have a whole closet full of things I've stolen from these guys. I get in and I'm like, oh, I'm going to get fired. I'm like, you know, he was sitting on the far end, sunglasses on.
Why did you get in
charcoal
there?
Charcoal beard. I just got confused because we were rushing out and it was like this Beatles moment where everyone was screaming and there was four limousines parked out front.
Were you supposed to be in a limo?
Yeah, but I was supposed to be in a limo with eight other guys.
Okay.
I just got in his limo. I got in the first limo.
If you weren't supposed to be in a limo to begin with.
Who knows if they would have let me stay. But I got in, and this is like 97. So like right when NWO is like just exploding. And I go to get out, and he goes, it's okay, brother. I was like, oh my God. And then so he goes, come on down here. And I'm like, I'm 26 years old. And this is like, he was like a legend.
Yeah.
And go down, and and like you said, for people who like kind of shit on him, and you, there are reasons too, like personal reasons in terms of his charisma and like his presence. It's like, you have to experience it to understand.
Yeah.
Like,
real quick, 5 seconds. Well, one time I was in the airport, it was like 9 o'clock at night. There was nobody else in the airport. I ran into him, and he, even though like people just walk up to him. And so I sat and talked to him, and we walk, you know, we're walking to the, through the airport together, and every third person would run up to him, grab him, put their arm around him without, you know, without asking if they could, and take a picture with him. And he was so gracious to everybody. And I can't even imagine. I mean, this airport was empty and he was getting mobbed. I can't even imagine if he got stuck in an airport when it's not. But I was so impressed because he was so gracious, treated everybody like a star, made everybody feel like $1 million that came up to him. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, he definitely knows what he's doing. But so he starts asking me questions about myself, just like you're saying, like he's interested in me. And I'm like shaking, And I tell you this, I've told the story once before, when he was like, what's your name? His voice is so deep that my balls tingled. I swear on my life that like,
that
it was
hilarious.
Like, it wasn't even sexual. It was just like, I was so overwhelmed, but the
tingling
thing was,
balls.
He did two things in that conversation that I still laugh about. One, he found out I wrote for WCW.com, and he was just like, yeah, man, what is this internet? I need to get into this internet thing. Like, it was like I was talking about like a fusion reactor. Like it was like, I was like, it's pretty much it was still 97, but, and then the second thing was he said, I didn't want to come back, brother, but the business needed me.
That's awesome.
It's so great. I mean, it was honestly one of the most exciting. It was like 40 minutes with him in a limo that every moment was amazing. Like, I just loved life. But that's me like going off with Seacrest. So this job was great.
Seacrest hosted the Academy Awards and you wrote for him, right?
The Emmys. But yeah, we wrote for him at the Emmys.
Never mind. And that's crap.
I remember that I wrote a joke. His favorite joke in the show was they wanted him to come out in like this almost Shakespeare in Love type outfit. And I wrote the joke, this looked a lot less gay on the rack.
Ah, yes.
But here's a real quick secret story. I'm super happy for him, by the way, because he's one of the hardest working guys I've known.
Sure you are.
But I am.
You don't have to convince me.
No, I am. He's always very nice to us.
And, yeah, no, you've always said that.
But my third day there, I was having trouble adjusting because his audience is primarily teen girls and women over 40. Like, they love him. Like, that's his audience. And they told me, they were like, listen, we're bringing you in. You know, hopefully you can write for this audience. This isn't like, this isn't Stern. This isn't like, you know, this is who we write for. And I got in one day, it was like the third day, and it was 5:30 in the morning. And he's like full of pepper all the time. And he runs up to me and he's like, hey man, listen, I had a funny idea. Tito Ortiz, I'm going to be interviewing him on the phone. And wouldn't it be funny if you gave me a list of imaginary MMA moves? And then I'll read them off, because I apparently the story was, years ago, Ryan had met Tito doing a segment on Jay Leno, and so they had some history. So he was going to claim to Tito that he'd been training since then and had learned these dumb moves. And it's 5:30 in the morning, and I'm not used to the schedule yet. I'm exhausted. I don't have any ideas. So I just like put together this crap list, like Indian burn. Like, I don't know what a fake MMA move is. But just at the end, thinking like, oh, you know, he's a guy, I'm a guy, it'll be a joke between us. Like, of this list of 20, the last thing I wrote was Cleveland Steamer. but I wrote it and purposely, like, made two spaces so that I just thought he'd see it and be like, ha-ha, of course I'm not going to say that. That's right. Crazy, but how right. So interview starts, and the way it worked was he would sit at this sort of the big radio desk, and I would sit in the corner. You couldn't even see me. I was just jammed in this little corner behind this partition on my little desk, writing him like instant messages and stuff. And so he starts this interview, and Tito is clearly exhausted himself. Like, he has agreed to a 5:45 interview. He's not happy. He's grumpy. Ryan's trying to be ebullient and fun, and he's kind of, oh yeah, and he's talking, and Tito's like, yeah, this. And so then he goes, hey Tito, I've been training in MMA. I learned all these moves, and he starts reading off a shit list of moves. Like, I didn't write any funny moves. Like, I couldn't think of anything. And so Tito's not reacting at all. And so I guess Ryan got nervous and just went to the bottom of the list. And he goes, oh, come on, Tito. You don't remember that time you gave me a Cleveland Steamer?
Oh, my God.
On live radio.
Awesome.
And everyone in the room, because the room was filled with like a co-host and these female interns, everyone's like, oh my God.
You like, had to think you were fired.
Oh, I did. I was like, oh, I'm done. And also the guilt, I had gotten my partner fired. Like, he wasn't even there. And you know what? He was so cool. The commercial came. He walked up and he goes, he says, what's this Cleveland Steamer? Is it like a slur? And I said, no, I said, but you're going to want to edit it out anyway. Like, he didn't know. He just never heard it before. He had right. never heard this phrase. And he did. He just says, don't do it again. He didn't even threaten me. He said, don't do it again. And then the next day, so when I mentioned instant message, what would happen is he had the screen in front of him, and I would write jokes while he was talking, and he mm-hmm. could look up at the screen. Partly, Ryan's a really funny guy. The part of the reason we were there was because he was always doing 20 things at once. He was always like answering emails and editing sound. So we were there to kind of, because sometimes he'd get lost in an interview because he was so distracted running his like empire. And so
yeah, it's an empire for sure.
Oh my God.
And he really is. You said he really is the nicest guy in the world, right?
Oh, super. I mean, treated us great. Like, just sweet. I mean, he would get aggravated like anybody, but he was also sleeping 2 hours a night. Never, ever yelled at me or my writing partner. I never saw him yell at anybody. But like, super nice work. I mean, ultimately, I think, and you react to this too, hardworking. Like, earns it. Like, he's working. Like, it's not, nothing's being handed to him. But we would get free food and products all the time in the hopes that we would talk about them on air. You know, like, people would just deliver. And someone had delivered these aphrodisiac chocolates. And so he heard it, and so he had them brought in, and now they're eating these aphrodisiac chocolates, and they're talking about it. And Ellen Kay, his co-host, picks up this box, which was pink, and she goes, oh, isn't it I love that they come in little pink boxes. And I wrote, so do I. just like, it was just a knee-jerk reaction to such a perfect That's what she said. Oh, man. Yeah. Right. You're right. And he just, he was on his BlackBerry, right? So he wasn't really paying attention. And he just looked up. And as soon as she said it, he goes, "So do I." And I knew, I was like, oh, now I'm fired for sure. Like, you know what I mean? Like, cause he's like America's sweetheart guy. Like, he can't be saying stuff like that.
He can't be saying he likes to come in pink boxes.
Yeah. So at that time, he again came during the commercial over to me and he said, "Chad," I was like, "I'm so sorry." And then after that, I don't know what, you know how it just happens. I just snapped into, I never made a mistake again. Like, never like that. Like, right. But yeah, like, I think it's good. And I think my hope too is this is an opportunity for him to make buckets of money and be very
visible. Hey, wait, he already has buckets of money.
No. I was going to say is that maybe he can, because the one thing that you always worry about with a guy like that is like, oh, he'll be dead at 50 because he's literally sleeping an hour a night. Like, just that guy. So it's just like, you got the baton. You're at the top of the game. You're going to make a ton of money, more than you ever need. Just do this job. Like, don't feel like you have to be on four other TV shows and
produce
12 others.
Yeah, but he's still doing it, though.
He will. And you know what? And it's like, I know that. But, like, that was my first thought when I heard about it, was like, oh, I wonder if he'll just let up on the gas a little bit. But you're right. He won't.
I was playing on Ancestry.com the other day, and I looked up, I decided to look up my dog, and apparently he's half pit bull, half monkey, and half fire-breathing goat. But I didn't find out if any of his ancestors lived in a castle with a moat or a boat. But nonetheless, my dog
is
quite
callback? Is that a callback to the beginning of the show?
It's a callback, and it's also a call to BarkBox.com.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I didn't see where the connection, so that's a good segue.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, here's the deal, folks. For you, the listeners of The Raven Effect, BarkBox is offering an opportunity to receive one free extra month of BarkBox at BarkBox.com. Every month, BarkBox paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match a dog's unique needs, including allergies and heavy chewer preferences. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, and 100% of our products are tested on our animals, so you know that it's safe. BarkBox is a great way to try a variety of treats and toys from local and small businesses that you may not otherwise be able to find. Each monthly box is themed Country Fair, Bark Ball, Pooh York City, Brooklyn Hipster, etc. New and unique toys continue to keep dogs engaged, interested, and happy. Certainly works for Gabriel, my doggy. If your dog does not like something in the box, and my dog Gabriel pretty much likes anything as long as it's for him. Even if it's not for him, he likes it. But listen, if your dog does not like something in a box, BarkBox will send you something that they'll love for free. And free shipping on any BarkBox within the continental U.S. Haha, so too bad, Hawaii and Alaska. To receive one free month, go to getbarkbox.com/raven. Again, that's getbarkbox.com/raven to receive an extra free month of BarkBox for free.
Yeah, that's good stuff. You know, also what I found is, you know, I've been doing a lot of shows at night with Jetso.
With who?
When
Jizzo?
That BarkBox shows up.
With Jizzo?
Jetso. Jets, J-E-T-Z-O.
Well, wait a minute. The internet loves to call it Jizzo, and they are extreme.
I noticed.
And you know what else the internet is not happy about? The fact that you call WWNXT WWE Next. Why are they upset about that? It's NXT is next.
Yeah, here's the thing. Because, and this is no, look, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But I would say to those people that you are like, it's a sheeple move to let them tell you that NXT is not next, because it was called Next first. Then they changed it to NXT arbitrarily. But it's an acronym. It's NXT. It's like scuba. That's
so
like
it
me
stands
saying,
for new extra time.
No, my point is it doesn't stand for anything.
Well, then it's not that's an acronym. An acronym, the letters stand for something.
I'm frustrated. I'm flustered. Here's the thing. I'll say WWE and not we, because WWE stands for World Wrestling Entertainment. But Next stands for nothing. It's NXT. They're just trying to get us to say all three letters. It's ridiculous.
Well, it could stand for now extra titties.
I guess if they're going to go with that weird extra spelling.
Yeah. So what were you saying? You were saying something else about the internet?
Something else about the internet.
I don't know. It's getting late. We're almost, the show's about done. Listen, let me say this, folks. First of all, next week, we are going to start bringing some segments back. We'll probably bring back the quote of the week, did you knows, and we'll start with them, maybe some viewer mail, listener mail. I guess it's not viewer. Hey,
I've got a lot of erotic fiction if I could get a minute.
Yes!
I've got quite a bit.
So we're going to start bringing that back, but we're still going to give you an hour of wrestling. What we're going to do is give you an hour of wrestling, and then we're going to give you 20-30 minutes of nonsense. So the people that just want to hear wrestling stuff, they can listen for the first hour. The people that want to hear just nonsense can tune in for the last half hour. And the people who want to hear both, which is probably 98% of the audience, you will get both. How about that?
But sounds good.
Let me say this too. Did we talk about this yet on the show about Oak Island?
No. In fact, we never talked about it, but well, you have talked about it.
Well, yes. Shush. Listen, I know we had the Oak Island cliffhanger going, and everybody's been waiting for me to have a guest that I could discuss Oak Island with, but I was on the show Beyond the Darkness the other day. It's a paranormal show it's on the Jericho Network, and they brought up Oak Island. So I was at their mercy, and I was forced to discuss it. So the cliffhanger you've been waiting for, you will have to tune into another podcast, the Beyond the Darkness. I think it came out this week or last week. I know it came out last week, as a matter of fact. And you will hear me discuss Oak Island and a lot of other crazy conspiracies, my thoughts on 9/11. But if you add 9/11 up, it's 18. I don't know. It's 20, I mean. What the hell am I talking about?
What are you talking
I don't know. I'm thinking of 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven adds up to 18. And 18 is less than 20. And 9-11 is 9 plus 11 is 20. Ooh. I don't know what I'm talking. I'm really tired, folks. I think the neural block that I got from my occipital neuralgia is melting my brain pan.
Oh, man.
My dog.
We should wrap it up, man. You should get some sleep. We covered a bunch. And also, remember, we're going to go deep into this Rex King angle, which is hilarious next week.
Yeah, and my dog's over there going, oh, not Rex King, it's Ginger the Valet angle.
Wait, but it ends with Rex King, doesn't it, the angle?
No, Steve Dahl. The angle is with Steve.
Wow.
Yeah, no, Steve Dahl was my arch nemesis. Rex was always my side nemesis. He wasn't really my arch nemesis. The Southern Rockers were, it was Steve Dahl of the Southern Rockers that was my main nemesis.
I think I have that same neck disease. I'm exhausted.
But my dog is over there. He's like shaking his head. He's bringing his paw across his throat, a thumb across your throat, like Art Anderson used to do, trying to get me to get off the air. You're done. Oh, he's passing me notes now that say, stop. End it. Anyway, so the website, you can find me at theraveneffect.com, Twitter at theraveneffect, and definitely tune into my Twitter, because I put up stuff all the time, and my meme maker, Smitty T. Mockingbird, the House of Raven royal maker of memes, has been memeing like crazy. Tons of memes. Great memes. Same thing with Facebook, which is at The Raven Effect. Fan mail is fanmail at theraveneffect.com. But right now, we're backed up on fan mail that we haven't read, so don't be in any hurry to send me anything. So, Perry Saturn, please give money to his GoFundMe campaign, because he is doing poorly. Hopefully, he's doing better now. I'm always scared to look, because I'm afraid he's doing worse. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so heartbreaking to me. But that's GoFundMe.com/Perry Saturn. The Jizzos, you can find them.
Ugh.
I mean, the Jetsos. Where can you find the Jetsos?
Twitter at JetsoTime. That'll be fine. Come see a show.
Or come in a little pink box. All right, folks. I am wiped out. Busby is another great show. Thank you very much. Don't you love when people go, oh, it's another great show? How do you know it's a great show? It could have sucked.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're doing the show. We can't. That's like a movie ending in the credits. That was great.
That's awesome. Thanks. Quote the Raven, nevermore.
Thanks for listening to The Raven Effect on the Jericho Network. Check out new episodes every Monday at PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on iTunes.
This is Bulldog Bob Brown. If you want to get...
Just read it.
If you want to get over and stay over, you should check out the new episode of Killing the Town every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes. Hey, Geigel, what the hell is iTunes?
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.